Talking with John Shakeshaft on 26th August 76 at Grenoble. So can you tell me when you joined the Cambridge Group and what your background was before that?
I did the Natural Sciences Tri-Pass at Cambridge, and beginning in 1949, the three-year course, and then finished up doing physics in my final year for the Part 2 honours. And this was at the same time I joined as John Baldwin and John Thompson also. And in fact, I'd always, since I could remember, wanted to do research in physics, in particular mm-hmm. the Cavendish Laboratory, because my father was also at Cambridge.
I see. In the Cavendish?
Oh, no, not as a physicist.
What was he, just for the record?
He was a minister of religion.
I see.
He came to Cambridge as a mature student and did a sort of a theological course. But anyway, where were we? Yes, so I always wanted to do research. In fact, I opted to do, well, I'd like to have done, I wanted to do research in nuclear physics at that time, which was the perhaps the most glamorous field in the Cavendish, still at that time. But in fact, they didn't admit me for that, and but I was offered a place in radio astronomy, for which I'm very thankful.
Right.
And so I joined, as I say, at that time with John Baldwin and John Thompson.
So I gather, at least from the undergraduate's point of view, that radio astronomy didn't have a big reputation.
Well, it was a very new field at that time.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't put it quite like that, in that Martin Ryle gave a few lectures, I forget just how many, maybe 4, 6, or 8 or something like that, to the third year physicists. And so one, of course, there was really very little known at that time, but as an introductory course. And so, in fact, radio astronomy was my second choice. I mean, there were other possibilities, of course, other research groups, low temperature and so on, but I was also interested in radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And I recall having heard at some earlier date, I don't know now when it was, of a radio program with Bernard Lovell from Jodrell Bank, presumably on meteor work,
right.
And, which I found very interesting.
But you didn't apply for that?
No, as I told you, I wanted to work in the Cavendish
Laboratory. Right. Oh, that's right. So now what happens to a new student beginning in his first year? Are you sort of assigned to a research project?
Yes, really. Of course, the group was very, very small at that time. You can no doubt got down in your paper somewhere just how big it was.
Right.
I could probably recall them all, but as I say, there were three of us joined, which I think was probably the biggest number ever been. And so that at that time, in fact, I now recall, I should perhaps specify, John Baldwin and myself were research students, John Thompson, had also came from the Part 2, but he was admitted as a research assistant for the first year, but then transferred to being a research student after that first year. Well, yes, the situation was that the 2C antenna was just being constructed,
right.
And one of our first jobs, I forget when I just turned up, but sometime during the summer before the term started, and was putting in, knocking in angle irons to for the cable runs, that sort of thing. So
right.
It was just chores which were going on to construct the antenna. And then Tony Hewish was appointed as my research supervisor, and so that some part of the time in the early months was spent helping him match the antenna which consisted of me being up the top of the antenna towers adjusting the matching transformers, and him down at the bottom with the matching gear and telling me what to do. The division of labor was that I was to be concerned with the radio, the discrete, the point sources, and John Baldwin with the more extended sources.
I see. So
I think he was. Tony Hewitt was my research supervisor. Was it Martin Rowell? I can't now remember. It was so informal.
Yeah, it sounds like it was just sort of a group and didn't really matter.
Right, yes. I think Graham Smith was John Baldwin's supervisor. I mean, Graham Smith was more concerned at that time, as it happened, with the extended sources.
So John Baldwin has said that his whole career has sort of been concerned with extended sources. That was sort of determined right then when...
I suppose that was right. Yes.
And yours, to a large extent, also with the smaller sources. Now, what sort of project did you work on for the first time where you got into some science?
Well, there was that first paper you mentioned. Martin Ryle was presumably something he'd been thinking about. I mean, suggested to me that I thought about what contribution in terms of cosmology the sources might make. And of course, at that time, there was no understanding of the nature of extragalactic sources.
Or that they were extragalactic.
Well, no. I mean, the identifications had just been. I mean, that was the year of the Rome IAU meeting,
right.
And Martin Ryle had been to. Presumably Graham Smith also, I'm not sure, I don't remember about that. But they'd been to that meeting, and Bardo Minkowski, or mm-hmm. one or other, I don't know which of them, had announced the, had that meeting, the identification of these Cygnus and Cass sources.
Right.
That was very, very exciting.
Right.
And presumably it was at that time that began really to think that I don't say I thought this, but I mean sort of these ideas began to be about that a significant fraction of the sources might be extragalactic at any rate. It was right. Cygnus the brightest, or one of the brightest, recognized as such.
Well, Ryle anyway had been talking about local radio stars. I mean, in his review in 1950, for instance.
Yes.
And so you think that about this time he began thinking otherwise?
I mean, it was presumably the identification of Cygnus, which began to switch ideas.
But that's
ideas.
Only one identification, though. Well, you've got Cass to balance that off.
Well, it's M87 also.
Well, that makes it 2-1, but still it gets to be, it's a real, pretty
well,
risky.
Well, I mean, the Crab and M87 were the first to be identified,
right.
Weren't they?
And well, that makes it 2-2 now.
Yes, indeed. Oh, well, I can't at this time remember what the arguments were, I think it was pretty vague, but at any rate, I mean, he suggested to me, I mean, there was the idea which Barbara Minkowski had put forward that on the basis of the Cygnus A photograph that, you know, that radio sources might be colliding galaxies,
right.
And so Ryle suggested to me that I work out the... you know, what one would expect, what contribution one would expect to the background if indeed they were colliding galaxies. And so I did this sort of elementary sort of calculation in terms of clustering and collisions.
Based
on
the known density of optical galaxies.
That's right.
And how did it turn out?
Can't now recall.
I must admit, I've never looked at that paper.
No, it was. I don't think it was anything, it's not anything I was particularly proud of, but it was...
Well, but nevertheless, this sort of thing became rather important a few years later,
mm-hmm.
when there was arguments about the... integrated emission of, I mean, in Ryle's Bakerian the same sort of arguments.
Yes, indeed,
not?
Yes, but they were, this particular contribution, which was in terms of colliding galaxies, had by then been...
Well, that's true, that's true.
By then been,
that was a difference.
Been overtaken.
So you were actually worried with how density implies a number of collisions
so
and
that's
velocities
right, yeah, so
and so
the,
forth.
The Spitzer-Bardo work and that sort of thing in dense clusters.
Well, okay, the next thing...
Well, that was one individual piece, but, I mean, most of my time was spent, as I say, in the early months helping Tony Hewitt match up the antenna, and then sort of getting the thing going,
right.
And then running the surveys.
Right, and you, in fact, are the head author on the 2C survey, and I think it's basically your thesis, right?
That's right.
So can you tell me about how the data were taken, sort of go through the process of what actually happened?
Well, the data were recorded on paper charts, as was the practice in those days.
Right.
And so that, yes, yeah, so, I mean, it's my job to, along with Tom Baldwin certainly, and presumably well, John Thompson and others, to actually to tip the aerials and to change connections and do calibrations and that sort of thing regularly on a day-to-day basis. And then to analyze the charts.
Right.
And so that a lot of time was spent actually analyzing the charts.
Now, what was the procedure for that analysis?
Well, it was essentially to scan the charts at each declination. I mean, I don't know if you recall the configuration of the 2C antenna with four paraboloids.
Right.
And then they were interconnected either in two different ways. I mean, either to form an interferometer with the east-west baseline with the narrow fringes, which was just the discrete source
right.
interferometer, which was the one I was concerned with, or alternatively connected to form the interferometer, the north-south interferometers with the lower resolving power, which John Baldwin was concerned with. And so, well, it was really a question of getting the charts on each declination. There were four charts with the different phasings between
mm-hmm.
them, with the different positions of the fringes. And then just fitting beam shapes to the fringe patterns, and recording the amplitudes and the right ascensions and so on, or times of transit, and trying to fit sources to these all together, all too successfully, of course, as you well know.
Now, what was it? One person that did all of this?
No. No, it was shared out. Certainly, well, I mean, I did some, and John Thompson did some,
yeah.
And presumably John Baldwin did some. I should think we did the major part of it between us.
But presumably you got together as to what you were going to find as a source in the sense.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, indeed. I mean, it was pretty tiring work, and so we did spells on the records, basically.
Right. But what can you sort of tell me what the criteria were that you were going on at that time?
I think I should be making it up, really, if I did. I mean, I can't...
you can't remember what...
I can't remember in detail, no, what the precise criteria were.
I can't remember now. It's been a while since I've actually looked at that memoir's paper. Maybe it's outlined in there.
I suppose it is. I would hope it is.
Well, sometimes that sort of thing, you know, I mean, the actual... nitty-gritty criteria is not.
Yes.
When, you know, you want to tell us how you calibrate it and all this and give a sample. And
yeah, well, I should, if I could say something, but I really should be making it up, I think.
Yeah. Well, okay, say it with that proviso. I mean, that will still be interesting.
Well, I don't think I can actually. I mean, okay. I'm not. I mean, I wouldn't. Don't think I can remember sufficiently. I mean, except that, as I say, we had a number of templates and fitted beam shapes and so on. But at that time, I mean, we just given no thought at all to confusion, and that was.
Okay. Now I looked at
the site, obviously, in retrospect.
Well, okay, you brought that up. I find it hard to understand. You know, hindsight is always easy, but a number of bright people at Cambridge, how this came about. Did you have any thoughts as to how the confusion was overlooked to that degree?
Well, I to some extent. I mean, it was an obvious problem in spectroscopy. I mean, an observational astronomer. I mean, with a training in spectroscopy. I mean, it would have been second nature to him to consider this one. Though, I mean, even so, I gather, you know, they hadn't. Even today, they hadn't really. Got sorted out just what the base level of their absorption lines is. I mean, this is a continuing problem, and but nevertheless, I mean, they had given already some thought to it. But and so I can only one of the problems was at that time that virtually none of us knew any astronomy, and certainly nobody in the group knew very much astronomy, and so that this was not the I mean, one just didn't know the papers.
Astronomical papers that would have helped, do you think? You know, you're saying that, for instance, astronomical spectroscopy papers might have...
I think that in hindsight, one ought to have thought to oneself, well, now, you know, here we are fitting beam shapes to a lot of confused situations. I mean, what other situations have risen? Have there been where people have thought about this problem and spectroscopy ought to have come to mind, and one ought to have gone to spectroscopic papers, for example, but just didn't occur.
Yeah.
And
there was no antenna theory along these lines.
I don't think there
probably,
was.
I don't think there was.
No, I don't. Not at that time at all. And. One just saw nice beam shapes, and said to oneself, "Well, there are sources," and wrote down the coordinates, and that was it. You see, well, now the whole thing got rather confused. Got rather mixed up at that stage because Graham Smith, I forget just when, had already published the log n log s method. I think this was in his thesis, almost certainly, and from the 1C survey.
Right. And Mills also had a log n log s in his 52.
In his 52 survey, but as you told me the other day, the 1C survey was before that.
Oh, yes, it was 2 years before.
Graham Smith's thesis, I don't know, I guess was dated 51, I'm not sure, maybe 50, 51, or maybe it moved 52, I can't remember. But anyway, it was in Bernie Mills, no doubt. Certainly, I mean, the idea that... plotting log n log against log s could give you information about the space distribution of sources was already in the air.
Yeah.
And
there's an old optical technique too, for getting
surely. I mean, it's in the sort of books on stellar systems, right. And the rest. Yes, there's nothing particularly original about it. What I mean was it wasn't the idea was there that plotting source counts could tell you something about source distribution. Well, now I think what happened was that there were students sort of getting these sources off the survey, and Martin Ryle was sort of seizing on them and plotting them in all the different ways he could, and distributions and so on, and found this remarkable increase of slope, and his active mind immediately began to work on what this could possibly mean, and once he took hold of it,
right.
You see,
there were no checks, essentially.
It was away,
yeah.
You see,
yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to sound as loyal, but it's difficult for a student, I think. Once professor at that time, once the lead of the group gets away like that,
sure.
It's very difficult to. It just never occurred to us. Was it. Clearly, looking back, one of us should have spotted it.
Ryle should have spotted it.
Yes, indeed. So, I'm not making an excuse for myself, but I mean, it should have been spotted, and it was very, very unfortunate. But I mean, just nobody thought of that.
And then, I would you say that having once the horse had run away a bit and said some things, then of course you stick by it for longer than. One has an emotional attachment, essentially.
Well, I think that's inevitably so, yes. Right. I can't...
We all do this with what we've done.
Indeed, yes, we all do that. I mean, I certainly... I mean, at some stage, before my thesis was submitted, I had read very grave doubts about... when all the criticism had come out about what I'd done and what had been done. But you see, at that time also, I mean, it was, Peter Scheuer had already devised the PFD analysis to test this very point. I mean, when it was realized that, as soon as it was realized that there was this possibility of confused records and what they might do, then, that analysis was done. The paper was published in 1957, wasn't it? His paper in Popham Philosoph. Now, he did the analysis, I guess, in 1955, probably.
Now, you are implying that the PFD was an answer to the criticism of confusion was invalidating the cosmological results.
Well, yes, indeed.
Well, memory is that Martin Ryle said that it wasn't, that was all along that PFD was a supplementary thing that he was planning all along. Now, Scheuer, I'm talking to you tomorrow morning.
Yes,
he's the one, of course.
Yes, indeed. Well, he will know.
I was surprised to hear that.
Well, hear Martin Ryle say that.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't venture to contradict that. I mean, if that was in his mind, but I would be. I would be a bit surprised.
Anyway, your recollection is that this began once.
Well, I'm not sure just now, when Peter Scheuer did that. I remember. I mean, he went off to. It was rather unfortunate. He went off to the army, they may have been the Air Force. I forget which he was in. He was called up anyway at the end of his PhD, mm-hmm. and he wanted to. At that time, there was national service, and he wanted to. He got deferment, as one could at that time, to stay out of the services until he'd finished his PhD. But he didn't.
Right.
I think he felt he didn't want it hanging over him.
Suez crisis just about then too.
Well, that was
56,
57 years. But anyway, no, I don't know that. But I think he. Well, it may be also that he felt that. Maybe he felt it was his duty. I don't know. You can ask him about that. But anyway, he went off at that time. And I did the calculations. He devised the theory. I did the calculations on a hand calculator.
I see.
For the first comparison of the theory with the observations.
I see. And that's what led to Ed Scheuer and Shakeshaft.
I guess.
That's 3C. That was analyzing 3C.
No, that was way much much later.
I guess there wasn't an actual paper.
There must have been a paper. I mean, there was a paper around sometime comparing. Peter produced the formula, and I did the calculations to turn that into. I'm sorry, I didn't do the comparison of the data. I did the calculations to turn the formula into curves for Martin Ryle, who then did the comparison between the theoretical curves, which I calculated, and the data.
So that went into the Ryle and Scheuer 57 paper?
That would be it. That would be it.
Right. So you assisted in that?
Yes.
Right. So, but now PFD, though, I get the impression from talking to various members of the Cambridge group, was believed to be right without a doubt, and I think history has shown that indeed it basically was right.
Well, this is right. Now, you see, this is what I'm saying. The PFD having confirmed that there was indeed a steepening of the source counts. I mean, it was inconsistent, you see, with the 1.5. Well, now this... made us feel that we weren't all that wrong, you see? I mean, hindsight, we got the slope too high, but we were absolutely sure that we were right, it not being consistent with a 1.5 slope. And indeed, the PFD was very, very convincing to us. Not everyone, I don't think, not many other people understood it for a start,
nor
believed it if they did understand it.
Would you think it's fair to say that the rest of the world, so to speak, was looking upon this sort of as a rear guard action that shouldn't be put too much weight upon?
I suppose that was it. Yeah. Yes, they just felt that they needn't bother to understand it properly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But anyway, we did believe it, and this gave us very great confidence that we were basically right.
Well, continuing this line of on surveys, I mentioned that at the Paris Symposium and then also in Ed Scheuer and Shakeshaft in 1958, you compared the 3C with the 2C and Mills survey. And this was sort of you had a log in, log S for 3C, and what did that show? I mean,
well, that indeed there was a steeper slope. I forget just what value that gave, 1.85 or something like that.
Steeper than 1.5.
Certainly steeper than 1.5. And, I mean, by that time we had realized, of course, that the 2C was wrong and hopelessly overanalyzed. Far too many sources. I mean, I think the Ed Scheuer Shakeshaft paper, said that, we ought to have gone down to about 500 sources rather than 1,800 or whatever it was, 1,900. And that was understood by that time. But we were convinced, that, as I say, from the PFD analysis, that it was a steeper slope. And this was confirmed by 3C, which was very carefully done. And we've been convinced ever since.
Was it really 3C that swung the Cambridge group over to realizing that 2C was seriously in error? Or was it the Mills survey, would you say?
No, I think that, it was a progressive realization. I can't really recall just, I don't think there would be any time, from now on, it's just a progressive realization that it had been overanalyzed and I don't think there was any blinding flash or intuition.
But when 3C was designed, well, it's my understanding that right from the very beginning it was planned to do a survey of both frequencies, right, with the area.
I'm told I wasn't there, as I say, at the design of that antenna. I understand from Martin Weil that it was originally intended to work at two frequencies. The original intention was to work at the higher frequency, when we would have been much less confused. But there were some interference problems which decided him to start with a lower frequency.
You mentioned this to me. Yeah.
Yes, indeed, which was very unfortunate. Had we started, I don't know how history would have been different had we been able to start with a higher frequency, the 178 megahertz. But the 3C survey really ought to come first.
And it's not really then fair to say that 3C was in response to the criticism of 2C.
Not at all.
It was part of the plan.
No, it was part of the plan. Yes, indeed.
I was looking at your thesis, which is dated 5758.
Yes.
And in particular interested in the comments you had on identifications. You had quite a long chapter on all the various possibilities, novae, weird types of stars, and so forth. And in the actual 2C publication, it's mentioned that about 100 of these sources are related to NGC objects. Mm. My question is, during this period, when still an extremely low percentage of sources were having reliable identifications, what were you thinking? I mean, was this sort of making it hopeless that one was really ever going to get a handle on these things? Or
so it was what making it hopeless?
The fact that there were no optical identifications. Or was it a matter of...
Well, it seemed very, very difficult at that time, yes, indeed, one knew well that the brightest source was already 17th magnitude, apparent magnitude, and so, I mean, one one might well imagine that most of them were beyond 20th magnitude, which at that time, with the positional accuracy one could reach. I mean, Richard, I mean, as you know, one was the fainter sources, one was delighted to get within about half a degree or something like that, 20 minutes of arc or whatever. So that, I mean, it was just apparently hopeless. But of course, I can't remember what date, but I mean, after 3C, I kept a file, as I still do, of all the sources and checking them off as identifications got made. And we got to I forget what it was, 10-20% of 3C discussing with Peter Shaw, would we ever have, level would this come to a stop?
And now, as we've heard at the symposium in Cambridge, we're up to 80% of 3CR, anyway.
80% was it, fell a third unidentified, isn't it? Well, anyway, 70%, yeah.
Yeah.
So that, of course, it was the incredible increase in the accuracy of position finding that did the trick. No, but at that stage, it looked very hopeless.
Who were you working with to try to get these optical images? Were you corresponding with people like Minkowski?
No, it was David Dewhurst who was the main person concerned at Cambridge at that time. Yes, well, of course, with Minkowski also. But David Dewhurst was our local, sort of the most knowledgeable person locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, he was an optical astronomer and knew all about these things, which we didn't really.
Well, I talked to him when I was in Cambridge.
Yes,
So it wasn't a matter of you dealing directly with people like Botta and Minkowski,
of course we talked with them when we met them at the Paris Symposium, for example, and places like that. I forget whether they came to the must have been at the IAU meeting at Dublin.
Minkowski was at the Jodrell Bank.
He would have been also at the Jodrell Bank. So that one obviously talked to them then. But the main local expert was David Dewhurst at that time.
Bringing up those meetings, I like to ask people what their impression was of the state of the art, so to speak. First, of the Jodrell Bank Symposium. Can you have any recollections of did it make anything sort of click in your mind that this is the way to go, or did you learn anything from that meeting?
Learned a great deal, yes, because the whole subject was so, still even then. There were two Jodrell Bank meetings. There was, I think I'm right in saying, the Jodrell Bank meeting in 54, a local one, as I recall.
There was one on meteor physics in 53 or 4, and there was the IAU symposium right before Dublin.
Yes, no, there was the IAU symposium in 55, yes, right. Indeed. But I seem to remember we had a meeting also in 1954, I thought. Perhaps I'm...
Well, that could be right. I'm not sure.
Which was, I think...
mainly just the British.
John Baldwin or someone may remember about that. I thought there was one. But anyway, was it 53? Maybe 53? I'm not sure. But anyway, yes, it was the IAU symposium, of course, 54, which was 55, which was when one really got to meet sort of all these people. There was sort of enormous progress, obviously, and sort of lots of developments, and so it was a very exciting meeting. I can't remember any great revolution in thought.
Didn't really change what you were going to do when you went back to
Cambridge. Don't think
Cambridge,
so, no, not especially.
And what about the Paris Symposium? That, to me, seems to be a very significant meeting.
Well, indeed. We went to that very much on the defensive. But confident, as I say, at that stage that the source counts were steep, damn it.
And then 3C was turning out well.
And 3C was turning, it was confirming that they were steep. I mean, I forget just what was said at that time, but I mean, I think we were ready to accept that 2C was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that was said at that stage already. But the source counts were steep, and Bernie Mills said they weren't, and he was wrong, damn it, he was wrong.
Yeah.
So that, certainly the PFD analysis was put over strongly at that time. There was that paper from Cyril Hazard,
Walsh
and others, you know, sort of, which were all a bit beside the point. I mean, surveys with the Jodrell Bank dish, quite inadequate resolving power, you know. So.
Why were they beside the point? I mean, wasn't there a point to try to figure out where does confusion really set in by actually doing a comparison?
Well, they were, yes, but, my prejudiced recollection was that they were beside the point. Oh, yes, no, I wouldn't say they weren't trying to do their best but to sort out what was going on, but I don't remember feeling convinced that they succeeded.
Okay, well, these matters are open for debate, of course.
Oh, obviously.
Let's see, I've skipped another thing that you were involved in at the Paris Symposium, and that was trying to find some radio features associated with the super galaxy that you did with John Baldwin.
That's right, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, well, it was...
The super galaxy is what the vocaler still talks
that's
about.
That's right, the super galaxy, and some... who was it, Heaton, or some American authors? Some authors, I think maybe it was Henry Brown. I can't remember.
I think it was Hanbury Brown, yes.
I think it perhaps Hanbury Brown and Hazard had claimed that there were radio features mm-hmm. associated with the super galaxy and attributed this to the excess number of nearby galaxies in that region. And we just showed that this was very implausible.
And was there any resolution of this? Any further study?
Well, I don't regard this as a particularly significant contribution, but I mean, I think we effectively showed that it wasn't so, and nobody else has raised the matter since, so maybe people believe this.
I see. You actually, I've forgotten this, you actually gave a talk at Jodrell Bank on the 2C survey.
That's right.
And possible identifications from work by Dewhurst and Minkowski. On the 75 sources with best positions and so forth. Yeah. Was that surprising at all? I mean, when you started the survey, did you feel that? Well, now if we really get these positions down to your accuracy was like plus or minus 2 arc minutes for the strongest ones, did you really feel that you were going to get at least a half a 50% identification rate?
Oh, no, as I tell you, the brightest source, I mean, the two brightest sources, Cass and Cygnus, one was 70th apparent magnitude, the other was 18th.
Yeah, but you had Virgo also, and Centaurus, which were not as discouraging.
Well, true. But, I didn't, my recollection is that one looked and to see, I mean, compared it, as you say in my thesis, which I've forgotten all about, but, I mean, when compared it with all the objects one could think of, plausible and implausible, but at that time I think I personally didn't rate the chances of identifying a large proportion of course 3C wasn't done then, but a large proportion of the sources as being very high.
It seems to me, would you agree with this, that Cygnus was rather critical in the whole business and influencing how...
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely was. Yes. All our popular talks at that time, I mean, presumably, I can't remember where this came from, it was Martin Ryle or someone, but I remember giving lots of popular talks, here's Cygnus, so that we're seeing a significant fraction of the way into the universe, you see, the cosmology was obviously a very, very important aspect of our thought at that time.
Sort of the kingpin
right through.
The whole
thing. Yes, absolutely. That was, again...
And so when you didn't find the identifications, then this more or less verified that to some extent.
Well, I don't say verified it, but
well,
I mean, it was consistent.
Was
yes,
consistent
indeed.
With,
yes,
yeah.
consistent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The only other paper I've got through 60 that was Conway, Shakeshaft, and Whitfield on the effects of redshift.
Oh, in the spectrum, yes.
If you had a nonlinear spectrum. Was this in Ryle's Baikarian lecture, he comments on this, not the specific effect, but the idea of redshifts and how it affects optical spectrum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was this an outgrowth of that, or was this sort of something independent?
I suppose it must have been an outgrowth of it. I can't really recall now. But there was the obvious feature, at that time, which may well be in the Bay Kieran lecture, I think it probably is. You know, I mean, what happens if you redshift an optical spectrum? I mean, the distant galaxies are indeed very red and begin to disappear rapidly. Whereas with the radio sources, the parallel spectrum will continue to be more visible. I mean, so there was this thought that you'll be able to another reason why you'll be able to see radio sources at great distances, and I despite guess, the redshift, large redshifts.
I guess with Conway and Whitfield's work on spectra, it was becoming clear that many sources were not straight spectra, and therefore, doing? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And they were turning over.
Right. But then, on the other hand, what were you estimating as the possible redshifts of the spectra you were looking at? I mean, were you really thinking of 0.5 or anything, something like this, by trying to just extrapolate if they had the same luminosity as Cygnus, et cetera, et cetera?
I don't think one was being too specific. One knew that Cygnus was 0.05, and yeah. One knew that one was seeing sources a thousand times fainter than Cygnus, okay. So that, they could well be very right. significant ratios.
But you had no predilections of what was to happen very shortly, namely at least the first quasars would be identified and point-like.
I don't think anybody... Quasars came as a bolt of the blue out to everybody, didn't they?
Bringing up quasars, now that brought back the radio star thing once again, right? I mean, here you had a stellar-like object identified with strong radio sources.
Well, there was the Sandage Schmidt paper, wasn't it?
Right.
61. Was it? No, Sandage and not Schmidt. Was it Sandage and Schmidt?
Well, Matthews and Sandage, maybe.
Matthews and Sandage, yes, 61. Matthews and Sandage. They looked at 3C48 and 196 and 273 PEMs.
But what I'm trying to get at is, it seems that in the late 50s the concept of radio star was sort of declining. That although your thesis, and even Edge's thesis on the 3C survey, is called Distribution of Radio Stars, which I find rather interesting.
Is that
just sort of a holdover of the terminology without any...
There wasn't at that stage any thought that any large fraction of them could be indeed stars.
Right.
No, but it was just that... I think this is probably Martin Ryle's influence... We just called them radio stars. I mean, they were what stars but point sources of radiation. And there they were. I mean, essentially in those days they were point sources of radiation.
One could argue that optical stars had taken on more of a meaning than that, namely they're balls of gas of such and such a size and range and so forth.
One could argue that, surely.
So what I'm trying to get at is finally when the quasars began to come along, does this sort of jolt your mind and say, good Lord, maybe these things really are stellar-like?
I can remember specifically being very skeptical of the Matthew Sandage paper, of their interpretation of them as being galactic objects. No, I mean, I've never seriously thought that this was a possibility.
So you were much more inclined to live with the luminosity problems, putting them very distant. Than to live with the problems of putting them close. Now you worked on the 4C survey also, right? I don't have your bibliography after 60, but is this right?
No, not seriously.
I see. So maybe if you could tell me just in closing a little bit about what you worked on in the early 60s, which is sort of where I'm...
What date are you going up to?
Well, it depends on the field, but is there a natural place between 60 and 65? What did you sort of get involved with after the Paris Symposium and so forth?
I don't think. Well, I got involved with, I think, after that stage, well, of course, I was involved with 3